This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
Kia ora, my name is Stephanie Gibson. I'm here with Lynette Townsend, and we're two history curators at Te Papa. And a big part of our work is collecting the history of New Zealand and people's stories told through their objects. And we're always looking for really compelling, historically significant material that can tell those stories.
One of our focuses is on a diversity of New Zealand history. So we're always looking for objects that can tell history from different perspectives, from different groups in the community, and just so that we can get a really diverse range of stories and experiences.
And so where are we standing now?
Oh, now we're in the Big History Store, and we call it the Big History Store because it's got large examples of furniture from the 19th century and 20th centuries. And we also have lots of technology here, like printing and typewriters and whatnot, and lots of big flat objects like wallpaper and posters. So very diverse. It's a huge store, and a lot of it's crated up for earthquake mitigation.
And there seems to be quite a rumble of air conditioning, is that right?
Yeah, it's all really air condition controlled. So the temperature's always 21 degrees, plus or minus 1 or 2 degrees. And the humidity is always the same as well. So that's the optimum conditions to keep the objects in perfect condition.
And so why is that? Why at that temperature?
Because it's dry and mild. So it's not too dry, so you don't want the wood to crack in your furniture, but if you have it moist, then you have other problems come in, like mould spores. So it's got to keep it dry, airy and mild is the best in terms of preservation for delicate materials.
It's all about keeping things stable and constant, so you don't want any fluctuations.
So September this year is Queer History Month, and we're looking at a variety of collecting institutions and the kind of rainbow materials they have in their collections. Can you tell me what's in the Te Papa collection in terms of rainbow material?
Well, it's really diverse. We have a lot of textile elements, so dress and fashion. Some of it's very flamboyant from our drag queen and transgender community. We also have a lot of sort of activist objects, so t-shirts that are emblazoned with identity politics. We have placards, posters from the homosexual law reform movement. And we also keep collecting material that's around activism, especially things like queering the night or queering the schools. And we also collect examples of popular culture, like the Top Twins, for example.
One of the sets of objects that we've collected or been doing some work on recently is the collage panels that were in the Evergreen Coffee Lounge, and they were made by Chrissy Weetoko. And so there's 35 panels that make up that collection.
So how do these objects come into the collection?
Well, quite often they are mainly donated, and quite a lot of the objects that we've collected in recent years have come about when we've done public events. Steph and I have done a few talks recently, and after that people have come forward with various objects that they've got. Amazon's softball collection came in through that. That was after we'd done the Asia Pacific Out Games. There was, of course, you know, huge, a lot of events here, and Steph and I did a public talk, and we actually asked people where do they see the gaps in the collection, what do we need, and a couple of people came forward and said Amazon's would be really great to collect, and from that we did a bit of research and managed to locate some of the old uniforms.
I imagine the research element must be quite large. I'm thinking, like, in terms of these panels from the Evergreen Cafe, where you've got like hundreds of photos, they're not necessarily identified, are they, in terms of the people in them?
Well, that's been a big part of the research, is to identify people, the places and the stories around them. And we've made a start on it, and we've got some really great family stories and stories from people that knew Chrissy, friends and acquaintances of hers. But I imagine that this will be a project that will go on for years and years, because the more you research, the more you realise that the depth and the more avenues there are to kind of carry on researching.
And then how do you document that new information?
So it all gets documented on our database. So some of the information is just kept behind the scenes, and that will be there sort of for future researchers. But we've been trying to write it up as narrative stories and then attach the related collages and other objects that help to sort of enrich the story.
What are some of the other things that you've collected?
So we've collected around other aspects of GLBT life that might not be so obvious. So, example, sport, as Lynette mentioned before, but also Gareth, as you very kindly helped us with, is collecting around the Out Games, the Asia Pacific Out Games, which is a really exciting moment here in New Zealand, 2011, and we managed to collect a huge body of material. So that really grew our collections in quite a different direction. So we're always looking in new ways to collect and collect different experiences of being GLBTI in New Zealand.
One of the other big collections that we've got is from Carmen. And we've collected several times around Carmen. So some items were things that Carmen herself donated. We've purchased items as well. And then after she passed away, we collected a whole range of objects as well. So that's actually a really rich and diverse and varied collection now.
Oh, and there's also, the Pacific and art collections also have collected material from the GLBT community. For example, the Pacific Cultures Collection has some wonderful examples of whaffa, whine, clothing and design. So it is the collecting's happening right across the organisation.
An interesting thing with Carmen is that in the recent kind of media coverage of her traffic lights in Cuba Mall, she's been referred to in the press as a drag queen. And I know in some institutions she's referred to as drag queen, others are transgender. How do you categorise people's sexuality and gender identity?
It's really tricky because we're using a Getty museum thesaurus from America. So we're technically speaking, our database uses these international classification systems, and they don't have all these nuances around identity and sexuality and orientation. They have a few. They have broad ones like homosexuality, but they don't have transgender, for example, as a category. So we have to embed those categories in different parts of the database and in our information, the way we deliver it online. We need to write that up and make it really visible online, but it's not actually always in the classification system and behind the scenes.
The other thing is that it's really important for us to keep connecting with communities that where those objects belong to and the people who those objects belong to. And I think the naming or the names that people use changes, and it has changed so much over time, and we try to keep in touch with that. And we're really open to kind of revising how we've kind of written things up and named things. So it's you know, I think even if something's been written up in a certain way now, then we're really open to kind of changing that and taking on advice.
So how does one change, say, like the Getty thesaurus? How does one say, actually, we want transgender in that thesaurus?
Well, we would need to work with our digital team here and ask them to champion it for us. And we have asked. We just need to chase it up. So we just need to make it an institutional priority, because I think every change costs money, basically. It's probably a financial decision as well. And also the Getty, with their international purview, will be having their own discussions around issues like this, I suspect. So we just need to become part of those conversations, or drive the conversation.
Another item over here is I signed 27 times. What does that refer to?
So this is from the Homosexual Law Reform Campaign in 1985, which got very, very vicious and heated. And the people that were against homosexual law reform ran a huge petition. Well, they said it was huge. They said they had so many signatures. In reality, they didn't. They had repeat signatures. They had signatures from children, people that didn't have enough mental capacity to sign. So their petition was a bit of a lie. And when it was delivered to Parliament, the day it was delivered was a huge protest rally in reaction to it. And people for the reform held up some placards, and one of them said, "I signed 27 times." So it's a very ironic placard, but it was a very successful placard and was picked up by the news media at the time, and it's become quite resonant. And it's just come into the collection this year, so we're really excited that it survived all this time.
And I think you were showing me earlier how it's not only what's on the front of the placard, but it's also what's kind of underneath it and around it.
Yeah, well, the great thing is that a lot of activists, of course, are active on lots of fronts. So around in 1985, of course, there was the Springbok tour issue came up again, where the All Blacks wanted to go to South Africa. And of course, in 1981, we'd had the terrible clashes here in New Zealand soil. So in 1985, there were more protests around rugby and apartheid. And so the guy, Hugh Young, who made the placard for the homosexual law reform protest, recycled anti-Springbok tour posters and painted on the backs of them. So it's a lovely combination hybrid object around about activism in the 1980s in New Zealand.
One of the things I think of when I look at the sign is that it was constructed for that purpose in 85, 86, and maybe was never intended to be here 30 years later. How do you preserve, conserve this?
Yeah, well, often a lot of kind of protest material is very ephemeral, and people never imagine that it's going to last. And so sometimes it's a bit of luck that things survive, particularly, you know, posters and things like this placard. But we do a lot of proactive collecting as well. So we try and collect around things that are happening at the time, so that we can, Steph particularly does a lot of collecting of posters and looking out for protest material of now, so that we can kind of keep those for the future.
Once it's in here, how do you look after it?
Oh, well, it's partly to do with the environment, keeping it in optimum conditions, so acid-free boxing and tissue, making sure the environment's really stable and there's no moisture. So, you know, you can imagine something like the placard could be in somebody's garage and it would get wet and mouldy and just become destroyed over time. So here it can just stay in perfect condition and can last, you know, hundreds of years, hopefully.
I mean, the thing to keep in mind is that these objects we have here are just the remnant of the remnant of the remnant. So over the years, objects get recycled, they get thrown out, they get damaged, and we're just getting just the few surviving remnants often from people's homes and collections. And we find that we're often rung by the families of activists who have passed away, and the families will ring us in a panic and say, "Look, we've got rooms full of stuff from our parents. You know, they were leading activists. What do we do with all this stuff?" And they've got a week to pack up the house. So, you know, they're quite terrifying, those phone calls, because you'll go to that house and you'll see the most amazing, rich record of protest history, and you know you can only take a fraction of it. So that's a real privilege when families ring you and they know they've got important stuff and they're desperate to find a good home for it and honour their family members who were out there on the front lines.
So when you can only take a fraction of the material offered, what are the things that, what goes through your mind in terms of how do you choose?
Well, it's a really complex, it's like a matrix of significance that you bring together, and you do it with your colleagues. You do it as a team, because not one person can ever understand everything. So you bring all your knowledge together and all your experience, and you look at the significance of the moment, what the object represents, its qualities, its aesthetic qualities or not. You know, ugly objects have great history too. So it's not always about how good does it look, it's about what it's saying and where it was and who held it and who made it, and did it change things? Did it change anybody's life? You know, I mean, we've got a great banner from the 1981 and 1985 Springbok Tour protests, and it's got egg on it because somebody threw eggs at it. And you know, we can preserve that. We can actually preserve the egg stain. Yeah, it's quite visceral.
Some of the things that are the hardest for us to deal with are things like glue guns and stuff that has been glue gunned together, and sellotape and staples that have got rust on them and things like that. But we do have experts here at Te Papa that can deal with it. Our conservators can kind of make recommendations and kind of treat things so that we can kind of, so they'll still last the test of time.
So activism is kind of one stream in terms of what you're collecting.
Yes.
Are there other kind of areas in terms of rainbow communities that you're interested in?
Well, we've got the amazing New Zealand AIDS Memorial quilt, but I mean, also that can be seen as an activist project as well. We have fashion.
We've got quite a lot of items that relate to performance. So Frank Lund was one person who, one group of collection items that we got in quite early on. Yeah, and that kind of transgender kind of performance wear, that's the sort of thing that comes in quite commonly because it's visually very rich and people think to save it, and it's the sort of object that kind of lasts. We've collected around Poor Gendon and the Fairy Stories shows that were on at Bats Theatre, and we managed to get a couple of costumes as well after he passed away. What else have we got?
We've got some devotion dance material. We're really keen to document those wonderful, very public parties in the 80s and 90s. Oh, sorry, after the homosexual law reform in 86. The real flowering of visibility and excitement in the 90s with Devotion and Hero in Wellington and Auckland. Massive, big public events. And so we've got some devotion material and a little bit of Hero material, but we're keen for more.
We've got some fun little dolls of the Top Twins. So they are two knitted dolls. So one of them is Camp Leader and Camp Mother. And they were donated to us by, I think, probably a fan. Yeah.
We also have, this is a bit of a tangential thing, but we have, over the last few years, we've brought in a really large contraceptive collection, which has a lot of safe sex condoms and messaging, which is just brilliant, and we managed to put some of that on display. And these are products that were made or put together by the New Zealand AIDS Foundation, and they are targeted at gay and bisexual men, and there's some really powerful imagery and messaging in that material.
Another group of objects relate to Michael Matar, and that's an interesting set because they weren't necessarily collected because of the gay story, but it was more like a fashion history kind of perspective. But I think that's another sort of line of inquiry that's sort of quite interesting, reading across the collections and kind of exploring and exposing or discovering the gay stories that might be hidden within our collections.
Yeah, let's talk about hidden collections. And I mean, not everyone is out. I'm thinking of like creators or artists. I mean, do you have many kind of hidden histories that you're aware of?
We're aware of quite a few. We haven't surfaced them yet because we haven't done a big research project in this regard, but we're really keen.
I think the thing about objects is they can be read and reread in so many different ways, and we're always looking for new ways that you can kind of tell a story around an object, and that's fundamental to what we do. So we collect objects, there can be an initial kind of history that we really know about it, but quite often research will uncover all the other kind of stories around it as well.
And also, I guess the reverse can happen too. You can take objects that people might think are GLBT objects only, but actually put them into their full historical context, like the New Zealand AIDS Memorial Quilt, for example, that, you know, AIDS and HIV affect everybody.
Can we have a look at the quilt?
So we're just going to these amazing big roller cabinets. We call them compact storage, and it means we can get lots of objects into a smaller space. We'll just, See, it's quite a big, big metal cabinet, and it's quite deep, probably about 20 metres deep, a couple metres wide, and there's a big manual handle that I've got to turn to get into these big, huge bays, we call them. Anyway, the New Zealand AIDS Memorial Quilt is so large because they're 16 blocks. Each block is 4 by 4 metres. It's actually really, really large, and we've managed to fold them down into a panel size. So each block is made up of 8 panels, and a panel is the size of an American grave. So that hopefully will sort of paint you a picture. And we've managed to fold the quilts into their panel size, so it's an eighth. Is that right? An eighth of their original size, and they're still really large, and they look like shelves and shelves and shelves of slim mattresses is what it sort of looks like. But each quilt has been lovingly conserved, folded up carefully, and put into these beautiful calico wrappers with bow ties. So they're beautifully looked after. It's like the best linen cupboard sort of that you can think of. And they're all numbered, and they've all been beautifully photographed, and they're all online. And we are always doing a little bit of research into them to improve our records. This is such a critical moment in global history, in human health history, in political history. When you think of GLBT rights at that time when AIDS hit the world, they're an incredible record, and they're also an amazing record of personal histories and family histories. They're incredibly emotional, they still make people weep, they still make people remember, and they also still remind us to be vigilant that we still have HIV and AIDS in the world. So they're very powerful educational tools, historical information that's embedded in them. They're really rich. Sometimes they can be beautiful works of craft. They can be really rough as guts. And as Lynette mentions, there's a lot of glue gun, a lot of glitter, a lot of fabric paint, some scary stuff going on. But they're a real record of their times.
But it's like, you know, it's the thing about preserving objects is there's a really special kind of history that you can tell around objects. There's nothing else where you can have that direct, tangible link back to a moment in time and the people that made that thing. So that's why, for us, objects are really rich and powerful. And I think they do evoke emotion where other things don't necessarily bring out that same kind of emotional response to history.
And also the AIDS Memorial Court is a living memorial. We're still used, you know, it's still used, if that's the right word. It still comes out for candlelight ceremonies. It still resonates with people. So it has a life. It still actually has a life, even though it's in a museum, it still has a life.
How then do people access not only, say, the quilt, but also the other objects you've talked about?
Well, the initial thing is everything we have in the collection is on our collections online. So we try and, when objects come in, we try and photograph them straight away and write up the history around them. So people can always access them straight away online. But also, we're more than happy to show our collections to the to anybody in the general public. It's just a matter of kind of making an appointment and coming in, and then we're really happy to show them and share our collections with people in that way. And then, of course, we're always looking for great opportunities to have objects out in exhibitions on the floor so people can enjoy them in that way too.
Yeah, and if there's a special community event and if it's logistically possible, then we try and be present in an event. So, for example, with the Candlelight Memorial at Te Papa, over the last couple of years, we've been able to bring out the quilts. So there's lots of different ways that we can provide access.
And so you're open for people to come forward and say, have you thought about this idea in terms of like an exhibition or?
Yeah, so we, Te Papa, as you can imagine, gets a lot of really great suggestions, and they're always canvassed in the organisation. We discuss them all, and it just depends on the upcoming programming, how we can fit things in. But there's a lot of huge interest groups, both externally and internally, and we've got to sort of negotiate and navigate them all to see what actually ends up in our exhibitions.
And how can communities kind of help with your research in terms of feeding into, you know, talking about the evergreen photos?
Well, we've been asking people to come forward and talk about the evergreen photos, and so I've been running workshops, and we've done a few workshops where we've sort of interviewed people, and then all that information has been kind of stored digitally. But yeah, so we're really happy when people come forward and they've got their own story to tell around objects. Yeah, so with the evergreen as well, I've got about another 5 interviews sort of lined up around that. And I think it'll be ongoing for years and years, and hopefully, because it's just so rich. I think there's kind of those touchstone moments in kind of LGBTI history, the big stories, but then there's just tons and tons of those lovely personal stories associated with them as well. And yeah, so I've been interviewing people, transcribing those interviews, and then writing them up into narratives and putting that up online.
And we really love working with communities, and we'd love to co-curate with people, in effect. So we really rely on people's expertise out in the community. We don't know everything. We only know a fraction. So it's really vital for us that we have good relationships with people in the community, and that we can be like a conduit to the National Collection.
So how do we get in contact with you?
So you can either go straight for Lynette and I or any history curator, but you could either just ring the general number or go through the inquiries, or ring up inquiries and ask for our email addresses. But if you put attention history curators in your byline, that will get to us.
And I've got a special email set up for the Evergreen project called evergreen@tapapa.gov.nz.
Sounds like an amazing job.
It is. Well, it's incredibly privileged. I feel really, really lucky to be able to kind of work with these objects and then connect with communities. It's all about these objects are really there for the people of New Zealand, and that's what we're really interested in, preserving them for the history of New Zealand people, and then allowing access or encouraging access and continually building up those stories around objects. We really want that to happen.
Do you have favourite rainbow objects?
That's a good question. People always respond well to the top twin dolls. It's funny, people absolutely love knitted dolls that represent real people, and people love the top twins. And I think that they've been really nice objects to have fun with. But, I mean, personally, I love the activist objects because I just think the chances of survival are so slim. And I know it's probably a bit of a sad reflection on society, but I do love the Queer the Night poster, which only came out a couple of years ago, was posted up in the streets. And I think it happened the same year as the marriage equality law was passed. So great jubilation and happiness over finally achieving marriage equality. But in the same year, there was an activist group that felt it needed to have a protest march around the danger and lack of safety at night for people, for the rainbow community. And I thought that was really sad and telling. In the same year, you could have those extremes, that there are still concerns and worries around safety and acceptance.
I really love the Evergreen Coffee Lounge panels, because I've been working so closely with them, and I've started to realise the more research we do on them, the richer they are. But I also really like some of the headdresses, Carmen's headdresses that are on display at the moment, but also Frank Lund's headdress that he, lovingly handmade out of bits and bobs that he found and crafted together, and it was something that he wore on stage and performed in. So I really like that.